Blog Talk Radio.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Main Street Universe Radio Network. My name is Daniel Michael, the founder co-creator of Main Street Universe with my friend Kevin Baird. Associate producer Janice R. White will not be with us, or Brett Hillman, this evening. But tonight we will start with Occam's Razor. When there are two competing explanations for an event, the Sipworn one is more likely. This is an argument, a principle, that skeptics often misuse to try to force alternate explanations to paranormal ones. Even if those explanations involve false accusations or do not fit the facts, while those trying to prove their paranormal explanations will cash in all their Fisher investments in order to conduct tests that will prove they're correct. Originally, Occam's Razor began as a principle. It goes like this. This was termed in the 14th century. Logician and friar William of Ockham refers to a concept that states that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily. It was not intended to be used to evaluate claims of the paranormal, as skeptics so often do today. We will be back in just a moment discussing paranormal activity, a soul, metaphysic, magic, all those things right here on Main Street Universe. And are the skeptics wrong? And welcome to another Wednesday edition of the Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. I'm Daniel Michael, and I want to start by saying that Main Street Universe is, in fact, a network of six shows, starting with this one, the one that started it all, myself, co-creator Kevin Baird, and now hosted by myself, associate producer Janice R. White, and Brett Hillman. Tonight I'm here flying solo, but I'm sure Janice and Brett will be back next week. That's Wednesdays at usually 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight it's 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Thursdays at 2 p.m., the afternoon show, the one daytime show we have on the Main Street Universe Radio Network, Miss Queen Mother Imaku with her show Uatau. She's a high priestess of the Kemetic African-Egyptian tradition. And there's all sorts of interesting things. It's an hour packed with a lot of information, original language prayers. Check it out on Thursdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Queen Mother Imaku with Uatau. Then Fridays, temporarily, Kevin Baird with his show Walking on the Sidewalk, A Horizon Oracle's Journey. Kevin is the founder, co-creator of the Main Street Universe Network, as well as being the creator of the Horizon Oracle Cards. He is an artist and does many other things, as well as making vases and the liquid smoke. So check all that out at www.templeofgaia.com. His show is at 9 a.m. in the morning. Then later on Fridays at 12 midnight, we have Jessie Ann Nichols-George with her show Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Jessie is the author of four books, Activating Compassion and Activating Compassion, the Companion Workbook, as well as You, Me, Life, Dreams, and Its Companion Workbook. She has all sorts of interesting guests, including on March 21st, her guest is going to be Mr. John Anderson, the lead singer of Yes. For those of you that remember Progressive Rock, he's still out there touring. I actually saw him here recently, I guess about a year or two ago, at the Hamilton here in D.C. Great venue, great show. He sounded great, looked good. So check out Jessie Ann Nichols-George with Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Then Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Darren Bouquer with the show Spiritual Insight. Darren himself has been on the Ellen DeGeneres show. He's done events such as events, readings for NVA parties and everything else. He's a reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans. So check out Darren Bouquer, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday evenings. And then Monday night, we have Science of Light, 10 p.m. Eastern Time with Vedic astrologer Randy Goldberg. Randy has been interviewed on CNN, on NPR, and in the Washington Post. So check him out, Science of Light, with your host, Randy Goldberg. Then Tuesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Green Magic, Green Medicine, with your hostess, Miss Susan Weed, the Master Herbalist. It's a half-hour educational show, so check it out, Susan Weed, the Master Herbalist, discussing women's health issues, herbal medicine, and psychology of healing. So that makes up the lineup for the Main Street Universe Radio Network, with more shows to come, including some rotating monthly shows and other things. Now tonight, our topic is skeptics. And what's interesting is to think of the idea of a skeptic versus a debunker. A skeptic is somebody who asks the healthy questions, employs the scientific method. And that's a good way to approach life and to approach issues and to approach mysteries. And oftentimes the slightly angrier skeptical people, quote-unquote pseudo or false skeptical people like James Randi and others, they're more like preachers. They're more like Southern Baptist preachers, but for their own version of skepticism or their own version of, quote, perhaps atheism, though it's not exactly the same thing. Let me get to some interesting articles that I ran into online. I'll start with where we started in the intro. Let's go back to Occam's Razor. First of all, Occam's Razor, termed in the 14th century by William of Occam. Again, I'm going to repeat this from the intro. It refers to the principle that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily. It was not intended to be used to evaluate claims of the paranormal, as skeptics today have done and so often do. To begin with, we use Occam's Razor to separate theories which would predict the same result for all experiments. Now we're trying to choose between theories which make different predictions. This is not what Occam intended with his Occam's razor theory. The principle of simplicity works like this. As a rule of thumb, some people quote it as an axiom of physics. It is not. It can work well in philosophy or particle physics, but left often so in cosmology or psychology, where things usually turn out to be more complicated than you ever expected. Perhaps a quote from Shakespeare would be more appropriate than Occam's razor, and that would be, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." The law of parsimony is no substitute for insight, logic, and the scientific method. It should never be relied upon to make or defend a conclusion as arbiters of correctness. Only logical consistency and empirical evidence are absolute. Even Isaac Newton did not use Occam's razor the way that the skeptics do today. Isaac Newton is someone who is as well respected by some of these sort of angry skeptic debunker types. We are to admit no more causes of natural things than such as are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances. Obviously, he was referring to explanations, natural phenomena, not paranormal or supernatural phenomena. He wasn't using it to explain that sort of thing. And being an alchemist, believed in metaphysical force as the alchemists did. It was part of their system of exploration. Brian Zeiler explains, UFO debunkers do not understand Occam razor, and they abuse it regularly. They think they understand it, but they don't. What it means is what when several hypotheses of varied complexity can explain a set of observations with equal ability, the first one to be tested should be the one that invokes the fewest number of uncorroborated assumptions of issues, problems, if you will. If this simplest hypothesis is proven incorrect, the next simplest one, and so forth. But the skeptics often forget two parts. The part regarding the test of simpler hypotheses, and the part regarding explaining all of the observations. What a debunker will do is mutilate and butcher the observations until it can be explained by one simpler hypothesis, which is the inverse of the proper approach. Second, what is simpler is often relative. For example, having a telepathic or clairvoyant experience in some primitive cultures is actually quite common. And those who have such abilities all their lives consider it ordinary and simple, not really all that dramatic, not really all that fantastic, not in the realm of fantasy whatsoever, but in the realm of basically everyday reality. So moving forward, sometimes the skeptics will invent an elaborate and far-fetched explanation over a paranormal one, one that may be more fantastic. Anything but a paranormal one is acceptable to them, no matter how fantastic it is in this material reality. For example, when Charles Tart did that experiment where a girl had an out-of-body experience and read a five-digit number on a ledge near the ceiling, the skeptics charge that she was carrying a secret fold mirror and a flashlight, which that had to be very difficult and much more fantastic than it just being some sort of paranormal phenomenon. If you're laying in bed and you have this funny flashlight set up with a mirror, that's just weirder maybe than just the out-of-body experience. Third, even if we take Occam's razor at face value, the way that skeptics misuse it Just because one explanation is more likely doesn't mean that it's always the correct one, which, as you know in life, there's always unexpected things. For example, if I toss a die, it is more likely, like rolling dice, it is more likely that I will roll numbers 1 through 5 than 6. But it doesn't mean that 6 won't come up. It's just more likely that 6 won't, and that one of the other 5 will. But that doesn't leave out the 6 definitely coming up, and maybe coming up multiple times in a row, and maybe get a big win at the casino. Therefore, occasionally, an unlikely explanation can be expected to be true. However, skeptics treat Occam's razor as if it were an absolute rule. That's our argument here today, at least this portion of the argument. Occam's razor was not meant to be an absolute rule. It was meant to be a system from which to break things down scientifically. That includes, or has become to be included in the modern study of paranormal activity, and often by skeptics, and okay if it's done with healthy, real skepticism versus the angry, venomous, debunking sort of false skepticism that I call it, that goes on. There are some of those paranormal shows that are very scientific, Hunters, one of them, where the guys do look for scientific explanations first, and they do a half-decent job. I can't remember the name of which one it is. There's one where they do a pretty good job, but then they also still admit that, yes, it could be paranormal. One time, I think it was the person had a bunch of very highly toxic chemicals near where the ventilation was blowing into all the vents in his house, and it was causing the people to kind of get a little, you know, feeling funny. So they look for the scientific as well as if it's paranormal. So back to the point. Occam's razor was not meant to be taken as a literal absolute for studying paranormal activity. It's a method, it's a way of breaking things down, which could also still mean that, yes, it could still be paranormal. So the skeptics have that one wrong, and they misquote it, and they may not even know the history of it. So occasionally, an unlikely explanation can be expected. However, skeptics treat Occam's razor, again, comparing a physical reality, they'll even use it, that may be more fantastic than the paranormal one. And the fourth point in this, in part of the article I was reading about this, which I thought was pretty interesting, skeptics have used Occam's razor so religiously by false accusations and denying facts and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For example, if someone had made an amazing psychic reading, like a really good one, and I've seen these before, where a really good psychic debunks a skeptic. Oftentimes, the psychics don't do so good in labs because the atmosphere is funny. But I've actually seen ones that have done good in labs. One of them, the most famous version, was a Vedic astrologer who was on the Skeptical Inquirer television show with one of the slightly nicer skeptics, and he totally slammed them. He floored them. I mean, he was about 90% accurate, and he was even put into a situation where he was set up to lose. They tried to fix the tests, and the people were like, nah, that's not my reading. But once the switch or the fix was off, they went, oh, yeah, that's mine. And so he's like, see, that was the right one. The whole point was they tried to even fix it. It was totally in their ballpark, totally in their backyard of the Skeptical Inquirer television show, and he still beat them. Now, not all psychics are going to do that well. This particular guy, who's a Vedic astrologer, which some people consider to be a particularly powerful form of astrology and divination, and we have one on our network, Randy Goldberg, on Monday night, Science of Light. He wasn't claiming that he had psychic superpowers or anything like that. He was just saying, I'm reading the chart, it's forces in the universe, and this is what I got. And he definitely won that debate. Now, let's get back. If someone does have an amazing psychic reading like this, where they're told something very specific that they hadn't been guessed by cold readings and et cetera, skeptics would start inventing false accusations, such as someone who knew you must have tipped the psychic in advance. Now, if that's done in a public environment, and you're just going to a fair, like say you're going to a psychic fair, or you're visiting a New Age shop, do you really think some spy is walking around going and tipping off these readers in the local New Age shop? No, people are busy going to work. These readers don't make that big of money. Some of them make livings at it. That's another myth. Some people think they're all rich. Some are. Some make... It's like literally any other trade or business in the world. There are very poor readers that are actually still very good, but for whatever reason, they're not great at bringing money to themselves. There are very middle-of-the-road readers that make a living, and they do okay, and they pay for themselves. Then there are ones that are upper middle class, and then there are ones that are super wealthy, like the Sylvia Browns and the John Edwards of the world. So it's just like anything else. There's a human element, and it's a trade like anything else, and you're going to have all levels on the economic scale. They don't have super spies out there spying on everybody that's about to walk into the psychic fair or the New Age shop, tipping people off. That's a ridiculous amount of operation. To even suggest that is just... How? If you're some guy sitting in a shop, you don't have the money to go pay a bunch of spies or to have somebody come in and tip off information like in some secret government operation about the person that's about to walk in. So, and that's actually one example that's been used before by the skeptics. Total nonsense. Another thing they'll say is, you must have remembered it wrong since it's fallible. You must have something in your appearance that reveals the detail. So there's all these different sort of excuses that the skeptics will use where they start to look way more desperate than the readers or the metaphysical people themselves, especially the slightly angrier ones like James Randi, where they just, and his foundation, he has an entire educational foundation based on trying to debunk the paranormal or anything mystical. And I'll get to him in a minute. Likewise, let's move on a little bit to experiences that I've had personally, out-of-body experiences, as well as we'll lump near-death experience into this as well. If someone during an NDE or an OBE, an out-of-body experience, hears a conversation or witnesses something many miles away and later upon has verification and it turns out to be true, the skeptics will say that the simpler explanation is the patient knew about the detail or conversation beforehand, but forgot it. Okay, it's not totally unreasonable. It's not as unreasonable as the other ones. A skeptic did that to the author of this one article I'm mentioning here. Once he brought up how a psychic was able to tell him that he had a tragic period in his life when he was about 9 years old without any other information or clue from anything but basically his date of birth, maybe his name. He kept insisting that I gave the psychic clues, which allowed her to predict, even though I guaranteed him, I being the he, the writer of this little story, that I did not. Examples like these suggest that skeptics are willing to support a false explanation rather than support a paranormal one. They will go reaching for things that sound more fantastic than the fantastic, if you will, if that makes sense. And I see Veronica's in the chat room. Welcome, Veronica. I'm going back and forth between the chat room and as well as reading and things like that. So now I want to start with a letter from a doctor, a PhD. And this one is from Dr. Grossman. And I found this to be interesting as someone that's in the medical profession and I think also does psychiatry and stuff, but don't quote me on that. But he is PhD. Anyway, in an editorial previously published in the journal, Dr. Grossman, in 2002, he coined the term funda materialist, to characterize a person whose attitude towards materialism is the same as the fundamentalists, meaning the fundamentalist, sort of hardcore religious people. In each case, the attitude is one of unwavering certainty towards their chosen ideology. For fundamentalists, which I think is a great word, I wish I had come up with that one. Okay. For fundamentalists, materialism does not appear to be an empirical hypothesis about the real world. It appears to be a given, an article of faith, the central tenet of his web of belief, his or her web of belief, around which everything else must conform. As all philosophers know, it is always logically possible to hold on to any prior belief, no matter what the evidence to the contrary, by making enough ad hoc assumptions. So I am not at all surprised that Keith Augenstein, in his recent articles in the journal 2007 A, B, and C, was able to sustain his faith in materialist ideology, even in the face of near-death experiences. This letter will not be a response to anything Augustine wrote, but rather is directed more to the scientist who might be, quote, taken in, unquote, by some of the fallacious reasoning that he and other debunkers customarily employ. I will discuss four such fallacies, three briefly, the other at greater length. So what he's talking about is the four, you know, points of this, what he calls fundamentalism instead of fundamentalism, which I thought was a great term. Augustine committed this first fallacy in his very first sentence when he claimed that a survivalist interpretation of the phenomenon is severely undermined by the overwhelming evidence for the dependence of consciousness on the brain. But that is nonsense. William James showed more than 100 years ago that the facts of neurology can establish is a correlation between mental states and brain states, and correlation is not the same as causation. The data of neuroscience will always be neutral with respect to the hypothesis of causation or materialism, and what James called transmission, the hypothesis that the brain merely transmits an already existing consciousness into the particular form that it is, us. Neuroscience cannot, in principle, distinguish between these two hypotheses. A second kind of error that Augustine and his fellow materialist ideologies, now this is the materialist guy, the skeptic, a second kind of error that Augustine and his fellow materialists frequently commit is to believe that a hypothesis of the form, some A's are B's, is refuted by producing many A's that are not B's. Survival researchers have amassed considerable empirical evidence to suggest that the hypothesis some near-death experiences involve veridical perception is true. Augustine counter-argues, and his counter-argument appeared to consist of little more than producing examples of near-death experiences with non-veridical perception. But the fact that some near-death experiences have hallucinatory features does not argue against the hypothesis that other near-death experiences do involve veridical perceptions. So, if the survivalist hypothesis were that all near-death experiences involved veridical perception, then Augustine would have a point, and his example would have falsified that hypothesis. But as all philosophers know, the word some has different logical properties than the word all. So they're getting into the arguing that, okay, some have, it's just hallucinations, some have, to simplify this, some have real experiences that you can really, somebody, you know, like reading the number on a, in a room that you're not in, or seeing what the weather was like outside when you were sleeping, you didn't know and you couldn't hear it. So that's sort of, I think, what they're getting to. And just by saying that some of them seem to be hallucinations, well, it doesn't mean that they're not real. And that's what this doctor is in fact saying, and he is himself a doctor. So he says, consider the following hypothesis. An advanced civilization exists on Mars and is living beneath the surface of that planet. Is this hypothesis possible? The hypothesis is not self-contradictory, so it is logically possible. But there is absolutely no evidence that suggests that this might be true. So it is not possible in the sense that there are any reasons to believe it might possibly be true. The hypothesis is simply a sentence that is not self-contradictory. It is possible that UFOs will land on the White House tomorrow. Again, that proposition is not self-contradictory. So it is logically possible. Just like we said earlier, it's logically likely that when you roll the dice a whole bunch of times, you're almost always going to get numbers 1 through 5. But you could have a string where you keep getting that number 6, the unlikely one that's going to happen, because the other 5 have greater odds. But that doesn't mean that the 6 can't appear. So in this suggestion, in this article, he's saying, but there's no evidence to believe that the hypothesis might not be true. That is, it is not really an impossibility. So, moving down a little bit, and again, there's the difference between what the skeptics will accept. They'll accept a theory that's crazy, like a psychic in a shop has spies. This is an argument that some skeptics have made. Like, these psychics are successful enough that they got spies, and that they ask people questions, like, before they come in, or even if the person walked in by themselves and didn't meet anybody. Well, at some point, this psychic had a spy, and some of these James Randi types will say that. It's completely ridiculous. Nobody's out there with a bunch of spies for readings. That explanation is less likely than that it's actually divination, and that it's actually communication through the veil. So let's move on to another article now that I'm on James Randi's case for a minute here. Now, this article is a few years old, but it fits just perfectly. And it's a little easier read than the last one. But I thought it was pretty good. For the last one was from a doctor. This one is from the Daily Grail I picked up somewhere. For 10 years, the modern skeptical movement has wielded a cudgel against claims of the paranormal. And James Randi, the million-dollar challenge, and many people in the reading and psychic and medium community are aware of this. In many debates over the possibility of psi or psychic abilities, the challenge provides a final word for one side. Has so-and-so applied for the challenge? The financial reward offered by Randi and his educational foundation is seen by many skeptics to be the proof necessary to claim that, well, since none of them have come and none of them have won this $1 million, then they must all be fakes. However, after 10 years, the James Randi Educational Foundation claims no one has ever got past their preliminary testing, which is, again, part of the issue. It's when something is tested by not just people curious, but by people with an agenda, the fundamaterialists, as the doctor had called them, called the skeptics. They're like fundamentalists, but fundamaterialism. No one of the, of course, the big fish psychics took the challenge, though Sylvia Brown said she was going to, but then she died. So I guess she didn't get the chance. I don't know the whole story, but I do remember that she had agreed to do so. But does the challenge really make a statement about, in any way, the existence of paranormal or psychic abilities? According to one paranormal investigator, Lloyd Auerbach, who, like Randi, is a illusion magician himself, it's important to remember that James Randi is a master illusionist. The suggestion that ending the challenge after 10 years supports any statement that psychic power does not exist or someone would have won the challenge is absurd on many levels. The procedure for the challenge included several hurdles in favor of the multiple outs, that Randy had, of course, not really wanting to give away the $1 million, him and his James Randi Educational Foundation, that any discerning individual capable of any kind of extraordinary human performance would think twice about. And here I'm just, you know, referring to the psychics and the like. So what are these hurdles that are being referred to here? It's basically kind of a fixed text, or a fixed text. And perhaps most important is the effect size required to win this challenge. While the James Randi Educational Foundation says that all tests are designed with the participation and approval of the applicant. Well, of course, if they're applying for it, then they're approving if they want to go further. So that's a ridiculous statement all by itself. This does not mean that the test is fair or scientific just because they say it is. And that becomes the problem. They're the ones that are in charge of the test, not an actual interested third party, which is my point. They control the whole thing. The JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, needs to protect a very large amount of money from possible long-range shots. So, of course, they ask for extremely significant results for the payout, much higher than a generally accepted scientific research would be for other things, even in a lab, that aren't related to psychic phenomena. In the case of parapsychology research, however, effect size is often fairly small, though apparently robust. This means that most researchers would have to go to extraordinary lengths to win the $1 million, and including ones that do get really good results. The thing is that the test comes off being a bit fixed. And that, which has always been my point about his test, is if I say, if you pass my thing, I'll give you $1 million, for an illusionist who's also been known to fudge the numbers and lie anyway, well, to me, those standards aren't any good. And I remember James Randi once saying, none of this is true, it's all in your mind. And right before I go on break, well, the mind's a very powerful thing, so if it's in my mind, and that makes me very happy. I'll be right back. Again, to finish off my point with Randi, the entire point about his tests is, A, they're totally fixed, because even if you come up with a successful result, as did the Vedic astrologer on the Skeptical Inquirer show, who's 90% successful, they will come up with an answer like, oh, you must have had spies, you must have had smoke and mirrors. They've done this before, when people had really big hits at psychic fairs, for instance, and they were like, oh, you have people walking around getting information. So in all kinds of fantastic stories. Now, I'm not saying that maybe some con artist may or may not actually try that trick. I don't really know. But the average psychic sitting in the New Age shop does not have spies out in the world asking people enough questions to get information. That is a ridiculous accusation. So, that is why someone can't win the irrelevant and now finished $1 million challenge. It would seem the modern skeptical movement would have all those bases covered. Think of it like this. If you don't apply, it shows that you have no psychic or paranormal ability and or experience. If you do apply and fail, the same. If you put your, you know, career, if you have that kind of career on the line and apply, well, you have to beat the odds of about 1,000 to 1 initially, and then about 1,000,000 to 1 to win the challenge. Then it still suffers from not offering or disproving or proving proof in the paranormal, some would say. Ironically, paranormal investigator Dr. Stephen Broud agrees with Ray Hyman about the merits of the challenge. The very idea that there could be a conclusive demonstration to the scientific community of psychic functioning is fundamentally flawed. Is that a scientifically ignorant showman should decide the matter is even worse or simply hilarious, and he is the showman. He himself is a master illusionist. So, that is the problem with Randy's $1 million challenge, and I'll move away from James Randi. I've talked about him long enough. And now we're going to go to Isaac Newton, because a lot of the skeptics that don't believe in anything spiritual or the, you know, divine or even just metaphysics or whatever often quote scientists like Newton. So here's an article from Discover, you know, magazine, fairly common and mainstream publication. I see Runes in the chat room. Welcome, Brett. And Lawrence Principe was sorting through a collection of old chemistry books at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia when he stumbled upon a forgotten manuscript written by Sir Isaac Newton. Any Newton manuscript is, of course, of interest. And the one he found was worth its weight in gold, quite literally. Principe is a chemist and historian of science at Johns Hopkins University, and I'm familiar with Hopkins, I'm from Maryland, recognizing immediately, holding the yellow manuscript in his hands and studying the scribbled words, he understood that he was looking at one of the best-kept secrets in the history of science. Today revered as the father of modern physics and the inventor of calculus, Isaac Newton was describing a recipe for the Philosopher's Stone, a legendary substance that reputedly could turn base metals like iron and lead into gold. Now, for those not familiar with the Philosopher's Stone, some people think it is as well a formula for immortality. We won't get into those sort of alchemy debates right now. But Newton's dabblings in alchemy were well known at the time when he was alive, but his belief that he had found the closely guarded blueprint for the Philosopher's Stone was what was the surprise. So it was known that he practiced alchemy, but he thinks he found the Philosopher's Stone. No one really knows. Newton was not the only intellectual heavyweight from this era trying to make the gold. The recipe for the Philosopher's Stone had come from his older contemporary, the famed British chemist Robert Boyle. As it turns out, Boyle was a devotee of alchemy as well. If two of the greatest scientists who ever lived were dedicated alchemists, then alchemy needs a makeover, a big one. Alchemy was not the misguided pseudoscience that most people think it was. Rather, it was a valuable and necessary phase in the development of modern chemistry. Among alchemy's signature accomplishments, creating new alloys, manufacturing acids, pigments, inventing apparatus for distillation, the process used for making, of course, perfumes, whiskeys, conceiving of atoms centuries before modern atomic history, and providing a template for the scientific method by running controlled experiments again and again. And as these alchemists, these people that believed in a degree of magic and a degree of wonder and powerful forces in the universe, that these skeptics do actually quote, strangely enough, because they are also fathers of science, they quote some of their things, Occam's razor being one, and various quotes from Newton, often misquoted as well. Now, there are reasons that the alchemists thought they could make gold, Newman says. They had theories about the nature of metals that made them believe they could manipulate their structure. They could also conduct experiments they believed proved minerals could be made to grow, which is interesting. In an age when there was no microscopes to penetrate living cells visually and no understanding of the nature of atoms and molecules, the alchemists were not misguided, maybe just a little bit misformed, but were coming up with the theories for these things, doing their best to make sense of the world they knew and the one that they, in fact, could see. That they understood as much as they did is really a marvel. In pursuing what today seems to be, like, to some, look like little more than witchcraft, the alchemists were, in fact, laying the foundation for modern experimental science. So the interesting thing about the alchemists is they're that place where science and metaphysics were still attached. But anyway, decided to look more closely at the alchemists who had influenced Blake and Yeats. These included the shadowy 13th figure known as Geber, whose magnum opus was called The Son of Some, I'm sorry, of Perfection. Not a modest title. Newman says, laughing, some historians had identified Geber as the translated name of the 8th century Islamic alchemist, but Newman's research turned up evidence supporting a different interpretation, and that he was actually an alias for Paul of Taranto, an obscure monk from southern Italy. To alchemists toiling and tinkering in the laboratory, Geber was an infallible master. His book was regarded as a Bible of alchemy. That's how much influence he had, Newman says. So, getting back to our point, the idea of the healthy skeptic versus the actual debunker with the venomous anger that you see out there in the modern era, it's become a fundamentalist, or as was said early, fundamaterialist religion of its own. And they will even offer theories that are crazier, quote-unquote crazier, than the supernatural and or paranormal, which, by the way, paranormal means of the normal or on the side of normal, something of that nature. So it's really not so scary, so crazy, or so far away from us. And another story I'd like to get to is in the modern times. Before we go, just got a couple minutes. And that's one that I've been interested in recently, is people's ability with emotion and with words to affect the molecular structure of water. And I found these stories to be interesting. This Japanese scientist, you've probably seen on YouTube and on other places that rice experiment, which is interesting. I've seen a couple of people debate it. One of them was saying let me explain the experiment before I go into who was debunking it. The rice experiment is you have a little cup of rice and you have a little cup of water. You add them both together and you have two or three of them, however many different ones you're going to have. Let me focus here, sorry. And then you say, like, reassuring and nice and positive things to one. You say hateful, negative things, call the other one an idiot. Then you have one that you ignore. So you have three cups of rice and water. One you say thank you to and nice things to. One you say negative things to. And one you say nothing to. Now, it turns out, after, I think it was about 178 days, the rice that was spoken to positively, it started to ferment and actually put off like a pleasant fermentation smell. Maybe it was starting to turn into, you know, rice wine or whatever. The negative one looked rough and nasty and black and gray, but it was still surviving. It turned out the worst one was the one that was ignored, was the one that no attention was paid to whatsoever, which plays into me that the universe is a social universe. And that is a theory that I do buy into and have bought into for quite some time, that everything is connected and that everything needs everything else. And when something is neglected, this experiment shows that. It wants to be what it is. Electrons are connected. They're all connected and they move because the other electrons move. I exist because you exist. Because we need the motion of the other electrons on a subatomic level to have that happen. Now, the doctor in charge of this experiment was Dr. Masaru Emoto. And if you haven't checked that out, check out the rice experiment. There are some people that say it's BS. Some people have tried it at home and said it worked very well. Some people had tried it themselves and said it worked okay, but they also felt like maybe when they did, they weren't focusing. I don't think it's necessarily responding just to the voice. I think it's responding to the voice and the emotion you put into the voice. Think of it this way. Dr. Emoto is saying that the molecular structure of water, and he's written a book about this. It's interesting, and you can look at it and decide for yourself. And the molecular structure of water changes when you speak into it. And it kind of looks like different snowflakes. I should have posted it on the page. Maybe I will later for the archives. And it's much more vibrant, and the shapes are much more vibrant when it's positive emotion. It still has interesting shapes with the negative, but of course, if you're doing nothing and ignoring it, you get nothing back. So the negative finds a way to survive too, like the dark side. The dark side survives. It finds a way. It's just not as pleasant as the positive one. The worst one is if you're no longer in the social universe, if you're no longer on the main street of the universe, if you will, and you're just being ignored. So the ignored one was the one that got the worst treatment, the worst result, I'm sorry, the one that he said negative things to and was like, you're an idiot, I hate you, to a bowl of rice. It was the one that, yes, it did degenerate way worse than the one that was nice things were being said. But as I said before, the worst one was the ignored one, which I found to be fascinating. So we're kind of coming down to it here, folks. We got a couple of minutes left. I'll make a few show announcements. We have been talking about skeptics and healthy actual skepticism versus angry debunkers, which are the fundamentalists of the modern era. They have their own, they're like Shiite atheists or something like that. They have their own anger they bring with them. I don't bring my spiritual path to anger with anyone. Being pagan, I could, you know, care less. I'm not looking for converts. But the fundamentalists have this thing where they, you know, they kind of, if you've ever debated them, I'll just say they're some of the most unpleasant to debate. I had one, he's like, okay, what do you know about the scientific method? And, you know, and they just assume, because I believe in spiritual things, that I have absolutely no interest in science whatsoever, which is completely ridiculous, because I've always been fascinated by science. I always like to keep up on new scientific inventions. I also have a fascination with cities of the future, That's why I was inviting Jacques Fresco and of the Venus Project to be on the show. They actually did say yes at one point, but I think, I don't know. He's 94 years old. He might have forgotten. So we do have coming up March 21st, by the way, for all of you that don't know, we have, I'm not in the studio, so I have to drum roll on the desk here. We have John Anderson, the former lead singer of the band Yes. If anybody remembers the Prague progressive rock band Yes from the 70s, 80s, and beyond, he's still out there touring. So John Anderson, the singer of Yes, will be on Main Street Universe Friday, March 21st, being interviewed by Jesse Ann Nichols George on her show, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. So, and I also want to congratulate Mr. Brett Hillman, our third co-host and former information specialist, for getting engaged. Brett is getting engaged to his girlfriend he's been with for a while. I believe they met at Convocation. So I see he says engagement, yes, success. So congratulations, Brett, on your sentence. I mean, on your getting married. And best of luck to the both of you. I've not actually. No, he's. Kevin says getting or is. No, he's not. He's engaged. They're engaged to be married. So he's engaged to. Well, I won't say her last name, I guess, on the air, but. He's engaged to his girlfriend. I believe they met at Convocation, a pagan festival up there in the colds of Michigan in February, which I think it just ended, actually, which I'm going to try to attend soon. And anyway, folks, I'm out. Remember that Main Street Universe is a network of six shows. There's this one. Usually 9 p.m., but tonight it was 8 p.m. because of various things. Main Street Universe with myself, associate producer Jeannie Sarwhite, and sometimes Brett Hillman. On the Fridays, Kevin Baird with Walking on the Sidewalk. Find Kevin at www.templeofgaia.com. And he's an artist as well. Liquid Smoke, Vases, Vases, You Say Tomato, I Say Tomato. Then we have at midnight Jesse N. Nichols George with Activating Compassion Midnight Hour, John Anderson, March 21st, so looking forward to that. Then on Sundays, Spiritual Insight, 7 p.m., with Darren Bucher, he's a reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans. Then Mondays, Science of Light, with our own Vedic astrologer, we mentioned that earlier, Vedic Astrology, with Randy Goldberg. And then Tuesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Susan Weed, Green Magic, Green Medicine. Thank you all very much for joining us. You've been listening to Main Street Universe. And remember, not everything can be tested in a laboratory. As I said in the movie Contact, can you test that you love somebody in a laboratory? Probably not, but you know you do. Have a great evening.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network. archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.